Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon, and a beautiful WIP day it promises to be, going up into the 80s, so it's a good day to be out and about. Maybe start thinking about your vacation if you're not already there. But no matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you. Always good conversation here. When we come back in just a bit, one from the archives, we begin the day with conversation from there. And then, always good conversation is timeless here on 94 WIP. The WIP time, 6:02. And we're back. And the conversation begins as I welcome Glenn Hamilton, author of a new book, Something Great to Pack for that vacation read when the beach and the mountains, or if you're just staying at home. Let me say good morning to Glenn Hamilton. Good morning, sir.
Hi, good morning, Peter.
Okay, how do you describe what you write?
I'd probably kind of describe it as more accurately a mystery thriller. There's aspects of mysteries that I really enjoy. I enjoy whodunits. I enjoy clues. I enjoy, as a reader, I like trying to figure things out as I encounter them. But I really like the action scenes of thrillers, and I like to mix the genres as much as I can and try to create kind of a smorgasbord of taking the best parts of books that I love to read and putting them together.
Who do you like to read?
I love everything from Lee Child, Harlan Coben, certainly. Robert B. Parker was a major influence. But I really like to mix it up. And of late, I've been reading authors like Elizabeth Little, Ruth Ware, Chelsea Kane, a lot of the authors that have broken out really in the last 10 years and are kind of dominating the field now, like Megan Abbott and Reed Farrell Coleman.
All right, let's move on to your new novel, Every Day Above Ground, a Van Shaw novel. Who is Van Shaw?
Van is a man who was raised in an unusual circumstance. He was raised by his grandfather. He's orphaned at an early age. And his grandfather is an Irish immigrant to the west coast of the U.S., primarily in Seattle, and raised Van to do what he does professionally. And what he is a career criminal. He was a robber in his younger and wilder days and has matured, if you want to call it that, into a life as a professional thief and burglar. And Van grows up in this world with a rather skewed moral compass. And very soon, as he ages into late teenage years, finds that he's coming into conflict with that moral standpoint. And he and his grandfather, Dono, he is named for Dono. They both share the name of Donovan. Van and Dono have a violent falling out in his around his high school graduation time, and Van escapes into the recourse for a lot of young people who have a lot of intelligence, a lot of drive, but not a lot of resources. And Van goes into the military, and he has served with distinction in Iraq and Afghanistan for 10 years when the first book in the series begins. And at that point, Dono asks him, after having no contact between the two men, to come home. And if there's an arc to the series, it's Van reconciling his upbringing with the morals that he learned later in the Army, and really trying to find the gray areas where he's most comfortable living.
Well, it's interesting because I hear a couple novels hiding in there just from the little bit we've said. I hear a novel about the conflict of generations, a novel about teenage rebellion.
Yes, certainly. It's there are flashbacks in all of the novels, starting with the first one, that talk about or show Van and Donna's relationship at various ages. In the first book, that skips around a little. We see him at ages 9, 11, 14, and so forth. And the way that their relationship progressed, and a bit of that story of teenage rebellion, as you said. And in later books, it zeroes in more in the second and third books, more on different events that happened in his life, formative events that would have happened in his teenage and slightly younger than teenage years. And that gives us a chance to, I think, tell a richer backstory without necessarily interrupting the flow of the larger action.
And this is novel number 4 in the series?
This is novel number 3. I'm working on novel number 4 now. The first novel, which came out in 2015, was Past Crimes. The second was Hard Cold Winter. And then the new one, as you said, is Every Day Above Ground, which comes out next month.
Exciting, to say the least. Now, I'm not going to ask, because that would be give too much away. Do the generations reconcile? I'll ask anyway.
There is a reconciliation. It doesn't always get the chance to happen face-to-face, but there is certainly a peace that comes between the two men that is related to Donna's reasons for asking his grandson to return.
Now, if I was a Hollywood producer, I'd say, does Grandpa want Donovan to do one more job?
No, he doesn't want Van to do one more job. In fact, I think part of the reconciliation between the two of them is Van's realizing that Dono does not expect him, Dono actually accepts the different path that Van has chosen for his life.
So where's the tension? Because every good novel like this one should have some tension going on.
Well, part of the tension is Van in the very start of the first novel, and I'm not revealing too much because you can read this on the flap of the book, is when Van returns home, he finds Dono shot and bleeding out on the floor of their family home. This is not a coincidence that Dono is shot on the very day that Van returns. And so the main thrust of the mystery in the first book is Van investigating Dono's recent activity and, in fact, what he's been up to in the year since Van has left, and trying to determine what Dono's intentions were in asking Van to come home. Why, in fact, Dono has asked him at this particular time in his life, and what's happened in Dono's life recently to make him reach out after all this time.
And it's got to be hard for the old man to reach out.
It's very hard for him to reach out. The two men are, in addition to having a lot of pride, which is probably what caused the initial break, even after they've cooled off and time has passed and Van has established this new life for himself, a large part of it spent overseas, is coming to understanding. Because even after you've gotten over your pride and perhaps you want to reach out, there's a deeper understanding and growth that has to happen on both their times. What links the two men, of course, is the woman they both lost, and that is Van's mother and Dono's daughter, who died when Van was 6, and that's when he came to live with Dono. And there's a fundamental loss in both their lives there that affects them both very deeply, that in all honesty, they never had the chance to talk about. There's some of that in the first book, but there's more as Van continues to progress as a character during the coming books and discovering some of his family history and what he thinks of as family. There's a strong theme of family running through the books, and a large part of that family is not who you were born into, but who you choose.
And that's an important point to make. We get two families in life, that one which we're born into and that one which we can choose, and they don't
Absolutely.
Have to be the same.
Absolutely.
Did Mama die of natural causes?
She died of a car accident. She was struck by a She was struck by a careless driver, just a distracted driver. And that's what Van knows about her death. Now, I will say that in books soon to come, that is a story I may be exploring more, because there are aspects of Van's life of which he is unaware, including his parentage, that we're going to get into in coming books. And that's the sort of the delight of writing a series, is you can delve deeper into the background of your main characters, certainly, but you can also assemble, as I like to do, a variety of colorful characters, a cast of characters that you get to mix and match. In the second book, for example, one of the minor characters from the first book is brought more center stage, and we learn more about his life, his family, and the relationship that character, Dono, and Van had as Van was growing up. And it gives us a chance to tell a richer story over time. I think it's one of the things that episodic television does very well, if it's doing it properly with its characters over many seasons. And it's something that you get to do in a book series as well.
Why'd you make them Irish?
I'm sorry, say again?
Why did you make them Irish?
Oh, I made them Irish partially because of my love for that country, visiting it. I also happen to have access to a friend who is fluent in both Irish or Irish Gaelic and English. She works as a speech therapist in Galway. And I loved the idea of Dono coming. He would have come over to our country at about around the time of the Troubles in the early 70s, when it was at its height in Dublin and in Belfast. Or sorry, not in Dublin, in Belfast and in County Ulster, where he's from. And so the idea of him, Dono, escaping that, coming over to our nation and going out to what in organized crime sense would have been the Wild West out here on the West Coast, because at that time, the West Coast wasn't under the control of any particular organized crime family, especially in the Northwest. It was more of a place where an independent like Dono could operate. And so I like the idea of him having an immigrant's drive, an immigrant's outlook on our nation, and giving some of that to Van. I also like the idea of the two of them communicating in Gaelic when they needed to be secret, when Van was a young boy. And that is, in fact, the language that Dono uses to communicate with Van when he asks him to come home.
Hopefully you give us translations.
I do give translations, and I don't use a lot of it, certainly. And of course, I don't speak Irish myself, but our good friend Anya does, and she keeps me on the right path on those few sentences that I do use.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPO Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Glenn Eric Hamilton, author of the new book coming out in July 25th, I think it is, his new book, Hard Cold Winter, part of a series about a family and crime and a whole lot more. All right. Family's very important to you, isn't it?
Family is extremely important. I mean, I have a very close-knit immediate family and a wider extended family, certainly, especially that I married into. And in addition to that, I think my larger family when I was younger was the family of choice, was the friends that I gathered around me. And because my immediate family was quite small and we were widespread, most of the family was chosen. And the two of them, fortunately, live in happy harmony with one another.
And it's important to the grandfather and grandson as well, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely important. And it, more so perhaps because there is just the two of them as they're growing up. The people that they've lost in their blood relations certainly hold a large sway over the two of them. But they both have their own chosen families. Dono, the grandfather, is really more of a loner. You know, he has a few Confederates. He has a couple of close friends, but certainly not the widespread group that Van comes to acquire. And there is a running a running theme or a running pattern that sort of happened within just the first three books. And that's the family that Van is building now that he's come home. He finds himself in close contact and soon a close friendship with an elderly neighbor who is a neighborly acquaintance of Dono's, if not a close friend. But he and this woman, Addie, hit it off because they're two of a kind. Addie is also sort of a no BS, a very blunt, but also very giving individual. And Van and Addie's friendship is something that grows and deepens throughout the series.
Where's Van's daddy?
Ah, well, that's a mystery that we'll get into in later books. As a matter of fact, that's an idea I have for the next book in the series, whether that's the next book I write or whether that's to come within the next year or so. But actually, Van's father has always been unknown to him, and that's part of what we'll get into soon.
But I'm sure Grandpa knows.
Oh, Grandpa knows, yeah. Okay. Or, maybe more accurately, Grandpa thinks he knows.
Woo-hoo. Mystery lurking right there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You gotta throw in some twists. Yeah.
Where's the mystery, though, in Every Day Above Ground?
In Every Day Above Ground, Van is in touch with a former associate of his grandfather. A former associate that had worked with Van's grandfather some 20 years before, gets out of prison and comes to see Van. And the part of the part of the tension of the story is what looks like an easy and unobstructed means of profit, what is essentially a deserted fortune or a forgotten fortune, turns out to be not so forgotten after all. And Van, who is at that time trying to rebuild aspects of his life because of events in the first couple of books, goes against what might be his first inclination and agrees to help this man crack a safe that has been abandoned for some 20 or 30 years. The safe is, as I mentioned, not so abandoned after all, or only appears such. And the two of them are quickly in a very bad situation, which Van has to then figure out in order to extricate himself and some perhaps some new members of his clan out of sticky situations.
Now, it's interesting to me. Grandpa clearly had one morality going. Van adopted another morality. But there's no clear line between the two. It sounds a little bit shaky.
It is a bit shaky. And Van himself finds it a bit shaky. You know, he's a person who went from a very skewed aspect as a child of thinking law was something for other people, really, to an environment within the Army and especially within the Rangers, the Special Operations Force, where a rigid adherence to code and to the person next to you was expected and voluntarily asked for. So possibly one of the more rigid codes that we have in our Army. And that was part of the appeal to me, is that he went from one extreme to the other. And as I said, sort of the challenge for Van is living in those gray areas now between those, and perhaps understanding that what he learned from his grandfather can be used for better purposes, and what he used from the Army doesn't necessarily have to be so rigid to get what he sees as justice done.
What, though, I think the two codes have in common is the value of loyalty.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's very insightful. And the certainly where his grandfather was concerned and his grandfather's associates were concerned, trust was a big aspect of that. Or trust but verify might be as well. I'm not sure Dono, the elder Shaw, truly trusted anyone, except perhaps Van. But there was certainly a close adherence to doing what you said and making sure that, you know, if you went in on a job with somebody, you were going to not let yourself be double-crossed, but you weren't going to double-cross them, right? You were going to build on that reputation and form those alliances over time. That worked for Dono. It certainly, loyalty has worked for Van, and when it comes to his former brothers in the Rangers and his friends now, he finds that family and loyalty are things just as critical to him as they were to his grandfather.
Van, having been a Ranger, does he have to use his killing skills now that he's out?
He has to use his skills, certainly. But one of the tensions, I think, in the first book is that because of what's happened to Dono, the assault on Dono and Dono being in critical condition, and Van returning to life and starting to poke his nose into what's happened, there's a lot of assumption that Van is simply going to pick up a gun and start shooting when he starts finding out what's going on along the way. Van, although he would be certainly capable of doing so, is perhaps a little more intelligent and a little more thoughtful than what people's assumptions of him. But certainly when push comes to shove and people start shooting at him, those skills come in handy.
Does poor Van get a love life?
He does, in fact, get a love life. In the first book, he comes into contact with a young woman that, of course, would have been in her early teens when Van left town, and now 10 years later is in her 20s. And the two of them establish a very careful relationship, I would say, because if there's one thing that his new acquaintance has, it's the desire to stay on the straight and narrow and a rejection of the life that both Van and Luce, her name is, that both Van and Luce were raised in. And so she has her own setting on the moral compass, and it's just as uncompromising, I think, or even more so than Van's is.
Now, one more thing about the books, and that is you have some titles that are pretty depressing. Hard Cold Winter, Past Grimes, and now Every Day Above Ground.
Well, that's modern noir for you. You have to give a little indication of what's going on. I hope readers don't define them too depressing, but they are challenges to be overcome. You know, every day, as I think a lot of people know, the full phrase is every day above ground is a good day, right?
Right.
That's used somewhat ironically in Every Day Above Ground because the criminal associate of Dono's that Van comes into contact with has, in fact, terminal cancer. And so he is the one who challenges that notion. And it is something of a study of making every day count. And so that is Van's life now. Is he's no longer perhaps living on borrowed time as he thought of himself while he was in special operations and while he was in active military, but his life is nonetheless very dangerous at times, and he's figuring out what he wants that life to be. In fact, if whether he wants to live that life, and so I think of it as perhaps more hopeful. that hard, cold winter, for example, is something to be withstood and grow strength from and overcome, rather than necessarily just something to be endured.
Did Van serve in Afghanistan or Iraq?
He would have started off serving in Iraq. He would have come through the Rangers about 10 or 11 years prior to the events of the first and then the later stories. He would have gone through Ranger. He would have had a year or so in the military. He would have had the training through RASP, the Ranger selection process. And then he would have served first in Iraq, where he was wounded fairly early in his Ranger career, and he would have served some deployments in Iraq, and then as events heated up in Afghanistan and special operations started becoming more involved there, his last few deployments were in the mountains of Afghanistan.
It had to be a devastating time of service for Van.
Absolutely. It's although It's an interesting generation, of course, or now a couple of generations that we've had in our special operations community of the friends that I've made and interviewed as part of my research for the books, is that this group of soldiers went into the military with us already at war, and we were still at war in those same fronts, in those same nations, when they left. So unlike, say, World War II, where someone might have entered, been in the military prior to starting, or have entered as a result of Pearl Harbor, and then served out their time in the service until the end of the war, they're a generation who's always known war. We've been at war so long, in fact, that many of those people were adolescents when we started these conflicts, and they're still going. And so Van entered the military understanding that he was going to war, that he intended to do that. And now that he's out, we're still there. And so it's a different aspect, because he went in with the full understanding, or at least his 18-year-old understanding, I should say, of what that what he wanted and what that life was going to be. When I was interviewing a friend of mine early on, in researching the first book, and I had hit on Van going into the military, and I thought, well, special operations is probably what he'd be intrigued in. And I was talking to my friend, who's a former Green Beret, about the special operations community and the branches of it. And he, and I'm going to clean up the language a little bit here, he described the Rangers, the light infantry unit, as knocking down doors and blowing stuff up. They are raiders. They go anywhere in the world in 18 hours. They accomplish the mission, kidnap who needs to be kidnapped, or extract who needs to be extracted, acquire the intel, blow something up, and then they get out again. You know, they don't stay boots on the ground in one particular place for any time. And I heard that, and I thought, that's my guy at age 20. That's exactly what he would want to be doing. He would be a raider. He would be the modern equivalent of a pirate, right? Of going in, accomplishing a mission tactically, and getting out. And he's been living, and that gave me a nice hook for Van reestablishing his civilian life, because he's been living tactically and almost moment to moment for so long that he has to relearn long-term planning for his own life. He has to think about, what do I want to be when I'm 30, 35, 40, because he's about 28 at the time of the first book, which is not something he's really given much thought to.
But there's always, at least when you write in a war setting, post-traumatic stress disorder. Does Van suffer?
He does. He has suffered in the past, because it is something that you know, active. We think of it as something that happens to soldiers after they're out of combat, or after they're out of the military. But in fact, it's post-traumatic stress is an immediate thing for many. It can come on later, certainly, but for many, it's something that actively affects them while they're in the military and after they leave as well. And it's also something that is a dramatic effect on the lives of so many, ranging everywhere from anxiety concerns, sleeplessness, all the way to suicide, which is a scarily large percentage of people affected by PTSD eventually lead to suicide. And so, although these are adventure thrillers, and we don't delve too much into probably the psychological trauma, it is an aspect of Van's life. It is something that he has struggled with in the past, that he has overcome with the help of therapy, with the help of medication, and largely with the help of people around him. But it is also something that resurfaces in his life because of the stresses of his coming home and the adventures that he gets into because of investigating what happened to Dono and his later adventures. It's not something that magically goes away, and it's not necessarily something that's away forever. Van thought he had it conquered at the start of the first book, and as I said, the events and the stresses bring those symptoms back again, and it is something that he has to grapple with. It's something I took very seriously. It's explored a bit more in the second book, Hard Cold Winter. I got to do a lot of discussion with both veterans and therapists who work in and around PTSD, because although it's not a dominating aspect of the book, it is something where you want to get the details very right. And it continues to be just part of Van's life, is that he just needs to deal with these moments when they come up, whether it's waking up in the middle of the night with a dream or whether it's an anxiety concern that happens to him. It's now part of who he is, and he has the tools to deal with those.
And you're listening to Conversation 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Glenn Eric Hamilton. He's written a series of books about a character named Van Shaw, the newest one coming out July 25th, I believe, the newest one, Every Day Above Ground. My name's Peter Solomon. Now I'm going to switch gears totally from the books.
All right.
Glenn. Why this character? Why this series? Why not a private detective or a cozy with a little old lady detective?
Well, maybe I'll write a spinoff and do a cozy with his neighbor, elderly neighbor Addie, and make her into the new Ms. Marple. But why Van? Well, I've always been fascinated, really, by societies that live in the cracks of current society, and really where it started was wanting to write a story about a man who was raised as a criminal, who was raised, you know, with those, not just with those skills, really, although that is fun too to research and write about, but really about somebody whose whole look when he described it in one article that I wrote a while ago about, you know, when we bring our children into a store, and young children, and they grab the stuffed hippo and they want to take the stuffed hippo away, is we have to describe to them why it's necessary to pay for the stuffed hippo before we can have it and own it, even though the child has acquired it in their minds and then has great love for it immediately already. Whereas Van would have been raised with Dono about the notion of, well, maybe when we walk into the store, we're looking for its weak points to understand how to break in later and steal all the stuffed hippos, for example, right? So the notion that Van would have been raised to see things with these eyes was very interesting to me. I kind of backed into the military aspect of it because of the fact that I wanted Van to break from that life. I wanted him to go away completely, not just move to a different part of the country, but go away as completely as he could from that world, and then return to it. Some of that came from my moving from Seattle, where I was born and raised and where the books are set, to California, and then returning to Seattle for visits. And noticing the dramatic changes that were happening to the city because the economic crash happened, the real estate crash happened. And while all this was happening and parts of the city were deeply affected by that, there were other parts of the city that were deeply affected by the other thing that was happening in Seattle at the time, and that was the boom of Amazon and the second tech boom and everything else going on, and these companies acquiring large amounts of real estate and building up, and a large housing boom that was a reverse boom that was happening because of that. So we had these massive economic factors and social factors happening to the city in a very short amount of time, and I was kind of fascinated by that. And I thought about what it would be like for a character to come back after 10 years to a city that he knew very well and rediscover it. And so those two aspects combined in my life to make me really want to tell the story about this person returning, not just to re-engage with the criminal aspects of his youth that he thought he had put down forever, but in a city that he used to know really well and is now a different place.
But does he also like to go back to Seattle to soak up the rain?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I miss Seattle immensely from time to time, and I get up there at minimum two or three times a year for both location scouting for the books to discover what's changed, because, boy, things are still changing rapidly. Streets that I thought I knew really well have to be re-explored. But also, of course, to see friends and family, which is the more important part. At this point, you know, we've enjoyed our California adventure, but we are talking as a family about trying to get back to some place in the Northwest, whether it's Seattle or its environs, simply because I do feel like the city is part of who I am, and I still feel very much like a Seattleite, even though I've been in Los Angeles now for about a dozen years.
It's also a place to get a good cup of coffee.
And we get an excellent cup of coffee and a good microbrew. Let's not forget that.
Okey-doke. All right. Well, why fiction? Why not nonfiction?
Well, fiction is more fun. You just get to make stuff up, and you get to go in different directions than what you might want to do. A journalist has to really zero in on the particular story that they're telling at the time. Not that fiction doesn't cut out extraneous stuff, but certainly with nonfiction, I remember your talk with Julia Dahl a short while ago, where she talked about the fun of fiction is that she can go off on those tangents and explore the interesting side characters, which as a journalist she might have to leave off. Well, the truth is there also for fiction and nonfiction as well, as though I think it would be fun to write some nonfiction about the boom of Seattle and what's happening there. It might be fun to write about the criminal community, or at least what I can discover of it in Seattle. But really, I have a love for colorful characters, the slightly heightened reality that we get in adventure thrillers, and I love to write a good action scene. You know, that's a great delight. And so that's something I get to do with fiction and explore maybe relevant themes that I might not if I were strictly laying down the facts.
Now, as a fiction writer, do you get to play God and move your characters all around and make things happen to them? Or, as some fiction writers have described it to me, the characters take off on a life of their own, and they tell you what to do.
Well, I would never say that the characters take over, but there are times when I'm writing a scene, and I need to have something happen, and I'm having a side character generally, maybe one that I don't know as well as I know Van or one of my main characters. I'm trying to have a side character do something, and I'm realizing that it's just the wrong fit. And that's usually a sign to me that I may be writing the wrong scene or writing the scene in the wrong way along the way. I would say, possessed by the spirit of the characters, but there is an aspect of, if I'm trying to shoehorn something in and it just feels clunky, there's a good sign for that. I usually have to step back and reexamine it.
We ever going to see, well, how long do you think the series is going to go on?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm having him age more or less in real time, but he's a young man. You know, he's only about, as a matter of fact, in the next book I write, I'm probably going to have his 30th birthday be part of the story. I'm having him age a little. I'm aging him a little slower than in real time, but I could see the series continuing for a long time. I hope it does. As I said, the joy of assembling a cast of characters and building a rich history is that you get to explore that further. You get to bring characters back that you've had before, and talk to them again and see where they are in their lives now. And readers seem to really respond to that too. They have favorite characters that they want to see return. And I get those questions frequently. And so as long as there's stories to tell and maybe more importantly, themes to delve into, which is what really jazzes me a lot, that will keep me coming back. And I hope keep readers coming back as well.
Donovan ever going to marry Luce and maybe have a few babies?
Well, we'll have to find out. It's not an easy road for the two of them. There's certainly a lot of love and attraction between them, but they are different people at this point in their lives. They're still both young. They're still in their 20s, so they've got some time.
All right. Dono, ever going into the nursing home or the cemetery?
Ah, well, that readers will have to discover for themselves. I don't want to give away too much about what happens in the books, but certainly the aging process of this older generation of criminals is something that we'll get into.
How do you choose a theme for a book, though? You talk about using themes and exploring themes.
Yeah, theme is something that I find comes out in the writing. I don't start out with saying I want the first book to be about forgiveness, for example, which I think it is. That really comes out. I write the book. You know, I tell the story I want to tell, and then in rewrites, in the next couple of passes through the book, I start realizing, oh, this is what this character is really talking about when they're having this conversation. You know, when they're having the, not the nuts and bolts exposition sort of stuff of moving the mystery along, but the conversations and the little side notes about what's going on, and how they're feeling about it. And then sort of I get a through line that emerges as I write. And that tends to be the hook. And then in rewrites, I strengthen that. I look for how that ties into various things. So it's a, you know, not to make it too pie in the sky woo woo feeling, but I do think there's a lot of work that happens when a writer is sitting down, pounding through the book, just putting words on the page, getting through it, that they don't realize is happening. There's a subconscious thing going on that they may be writing about that they're not fully aware of, unless they come back to it, read it fresh, and go, oh, okay, this is a darker scene than I thought it was, or this is a kinder scene than I thought it was, and then talking about that tone and where that tone comes from and thinking hard about it, that's where theme emerges, and that gives you a really, I think that's where a strength of a lot of, especially modern day mysteries, come from, is most modern mysteries that I read today, they aren't just the locked room story of how did it get done. They're also talking about the impact that the mystery has and the crime has on the individuals involved.
Is it easy for you to write, or is it like some writers have described it, opening a vein and bleeding on the page?
Well, it's. I'll put it this way: when I'm in the zone, when things are flowing, it's fairly easy to get that first draft down. Rewriting is a little tougher. I'm actually on a panel at California Crime Writers Conference, which is coming up this next weekend, which is specifically about rewriting. And rewriting can be tougher because you've got to, as the saying goes, you got to kill your darlings. You got to get rid of extraneous stuff that doesn't serve the story, however brilliant you might think it is. But you've got to really reshape it. And that, for me, is the harder work. However, it's also where the book really starts to take shape and just, goes from this sort of workaday story and amorphous blob into something that I really feel, you know, deserves the word novel around it, that makes it an actual book and an actual theme that runs through. That's where the work comes for me, and where the harder work is, but it's also where the delight is.
And I'm talking with Glenn Eric Hamilton here on Conversation 94 WIP, and we're talking about his new novel in the process of writing. The new novel, coming out July 25th, Every Day Above Ground, a Van Shawn novel. Pack it for vacation. I know I will. Now, do you tour with the book?
I tour a little bit. When the book comes out, now, I mean, the days of big book tours for most authors, except those really at the what I would consider the high end, the folks who are already bestsellers and whose names can pull in a huge audience. The days of those sorts of book tours are long past at this point. That said, my publisher is kind enough certainly to send me out to Seattle, certainly where the books are based and where I'm from, and to points here in the Los Angeles area and to a couple of the major booksellers in the Southwest, where I get to visit and get to meet people directly who I don't meet at mystery conferences and things of that nature, and get to meet the booksellers directly, which is always a delight. I really enjoy touring, and I really enjoy visiting booksellers and talking with folks and doing Q&As. That, to me, is one of the most fun aspects of this job, because it is such a solitary profession, sitting down and pounding out pages. It's you know, that's a lot of alone time. And to get out and to talk with other writers, to talk with fans of the genre, you know, that is a huge delight. I only really do that around book launch time, but during the rest of the year, there are conferences like California Crime Writers, like VoucherCon, like Thriller Fest, like Left Coast Crime, that, finances allowing, I get to get out to and socialize a little bit and get out of my cave. So yeah. that's a lot of fun.
Well, tell the good folks at HarperCollins, your publisher, the East Coast wants you.
Oh, I would be delighted. Believe me, I'm able to get out to Thriller Fest in New York most years. That's where I got my got started. Really, that's where I got my agent, and of course that's where HarperCollins / William Morrow is located. And so I get to get out there about once a year, but I would love to explore the East Coast more. I love it every time I'm able to get out to visit you guys. And with a little luck, I'll be out there soon.
Well, let me ask you a question then about your publisher, HarperCollins / William Morrow. The publishing world seems to be contracting. More and more publishers are merging with other publishers, like your publisher, for example. Used to be two independents, and now they're one. Does that concern you at all, or is it a good thing?
Well, I'm still something of a newbie to the publishing industry, so I don't have maybe the benefit of history to really seeing changes over a lot of time. It is true that the larger publishers certainly have done a lot of amoeba-like merging, you know, during the past 10, 15 years, and I expect that will probably continue. At the same time, the digital revolution, not just for ebooks, but for just the act of printing, you know, the ability to print physical copies of books, has allowed a lot of smaller presses to survive and to launch in this area as well. And so while we're seeing at the larger end, I think, well, it seems to me at the larger end that we're getting an emerging of these big entities, these big publishing entities, we're also seeing a lot of niche publications being able to get started and survive on a smaller budget and really get into that sort of niche marketing, largely in the way that niche channels do in cable, right? They don't necessarily need to pull the largest audience in the world in order to find their people, in order to find what will sell for them. And so, you know, I think that's a... Any way books get into the hands of readers, I'm always happy with. You know, whether it's digital, whether it's Amazon, whether it's through the booksellers and so forth. I always like to support and encourage friends to support my independent booksellers that I know. Seattle, I'll put in a plug for Seattle Mystery Bookshop, my hometown mystery hub. And I always encourage friends when they're buying to go through those venues whenever they can. That said, in the larger sense, people are still reading. You know, the physical bookstore hasn't died. The smaller imprint hasn't died. And I think it finds a way to survive. Life will out, right?
Absolutely. And certainly there's the ebook. I know my wife and her Nook, United Forever, but that's another discussion. Which is more important to you, a good review or a fat royalty check?
Well, I'll say I'm early enough in my career that fat royalty checks haven't been a concern as of yet. Hopefully I'll get there someday. I will say I can coast on a good review a long time, probably longer than the fat royalty check will last in the bank account. So, you know, I've been lucky enough to get a lot of attention and good attention for the books in the series. The latest one just got a starred review for Publishers Weekly, and that came out 2 weeks ago, and I'm still flying on top of that. So I'm at this point in my career, the good review means a lot, and I hope it never stops meaning a lot.
And you walk into a bookstore, the mystery thriller section, and there's your face on the back of a book. What does that do?
Well, it's a little startling. It's funny. The first time someone contacts you whom you've never met and says that they love your writing is a moment that you never forget, right? And it's a joy, much like the reviews, that I hope I never get used to. You know, there's just an intrinsic delight in being able to tell a story and have someone enjoy it who would not have known you otherwise, right? Who would not have known you through friends or family or even necessarily through the conferences. And so it's a little odd to think that there's not that I have any level of fame at all, but just that there's this notion of a public persona out there that people know you through your writing, whom you've never met, and maybe know more about you than you think they know because of who they met. So it's very strange to walk in, and delightful to walk into a bookstore and realize that something you created is there. We call it when friends who are writers and I post on social media, we call it caught in the wild, right? Where you'll walk into a bookstore in a city you've never been in, and you'll see your book there in a bookshelf. And so that's a sort of a magical aspect of it. But it's also a little startling to understand that there's a version of you out there that you only have so much control over.
But how much of you is in the books? I mean, are you Van Shaw?
I am not Van. Van is, I always think there's a little bit of wish fulfillment that comes in with any author, especially writing, you know, things like action thrillers, where the hero is always tougher, smarter, quicker than the author could hope to be. But, there's a bit of that in it. But Van has a different, very different upbringing than I do, but nevertheless, I think he and I have very similar attitudes. The sardonic thoughts that Van has are generally mine. And so personality-wise, although we're separated both by years and by experience, we've ended up in largely the same place. So I have great affection for Van, but I also write about things with Van, him being younger than I am, where those are attitudes or times that I used to have in my life. And Van has lived a very closed existence for a lot of his life, especially, you know, certainly in the Army, which he was totally dedicated to for many years. And now he's reestablishing himself in the world around him. And he's got lessons, social and otherwise, that he has to learn, that fortunately are, I think, at this point behind me in my life.
And now for my final question. Any nibbles from Hollywood, big or small screen?
Oh, well, there is, you know, my agent, wonderful agent with the Aaron Priest Agency, does have contacts here in Hollywood, which is near where I live. And there have been nibbles here and there, but I'm gonna go back to one of the first authors we mentioned, Lee Child. Just before the Jack Reacher series was already a bestseller, but it wasn't the huge phenomenon that it is now. When I first moved to LA, and Lee came, and I subsequently met Lee through Thriller Fest and through ITW, and he was kind enough to blurb my first book. But long before this, he came to California to talk to the studios. And while he was in California, he came to our local library, which is actually where I started sitting down and writing, came to our local library and gave a speech. And he attracted, at that point in his writing career, he attracted about 50, 60, 70 people, right? Nowadays, he would attract 500 or 600 easily if he was giving a speech locally. So he had written about 9 or 10 Reacher novels at that point. And he said, and he was in town to talk to studios, and he was talking to us about that, and he said, the only real control that a writer has is whom to sell it to, right? Because once the writer makes that decision and the movie production or TV production gets started, unless they're a really big name, like a J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter, they don't have any aspect on production control. They have to trust that to the machine that's making it. And they have to trust that those individuals understand what the book's about and understand, too, that the changes will have to be made. And they'll have to roll with that. And so I don't put a lot of mental weight on the notion of what might happen to the books long term. You know, if at some point we get to the point where the books have a big enough following that we're getting serious bites from Hollywood, and that we find somebody who I think will do a good job with that, and that my agent agrees would do a good job, that's roads that we'll cross to. But I also understand that my job is to write the books and write the best series of books that I can do, and it will always be that, right? It will never not be that. I won't worry too much about what other media might turn it into at some point. I'll cross those bridges or burn those bridges when we come to them.
And I'd like to say thank you to Glenn Eric Hamilton. It's been fun. Thank you, Glenn. Your new book coming out July 25th, Every Day Above Ground, a Van Shaw novel, number 3 in the series. Pack it for vacation.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you so much, Peter. Great
My
to talk
pleasure.
To you.
And it's been Conversation. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. Nothing left to say, but see you soon.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.